The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 37 of The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. And after that dream I just had, I will eat no more rarebit. Our guest today is Brent Walker. Brent is a Renaissance man, film historian, and an author, and a musician. He has a band called the Ding Dong Devils. And if you can come up with a better name than that, I challenge you to do so. That's a great one. And it's a great band. And I've been after Brent for quite a long time, which will explain one of the oddities of this particular episode. I went to see last week, I went to see Brent give a presentation at the Studio City Library on Mack Sennett. Brent is the author of an incredible book called Mack Sennett's Fun Factory, and I will put a link to that on his page on thecommentarytrack.com. It's a big, thorough book with lots of info and lots of great history. And it's a tad on the expensive side, but believe me, it's worth it. Anyway, I was at the Studio City Library with a standing room only crowd watching Brent, and because he lives a little bit of a distance away from me, and so we'd been going back and forth on how to get together to do this. And we decided, since he was coming to my neck of the woods, that we would just do it at the library. We figured after his presentation, we would just stay there after the crowd dispersed and do the commentary track then. What we should have realized, but didn't, was that the library closed as soon as the presentation was over, and we were kicked out into the street. We were actually picked up by the scruff of our necks and tossed out into the streets. And then all of our computers and books, everything tossed out after us. It was humiliating. But we needed to find some place to do the interview, and somebody suggested a nearby coffee house, which, for reasons of having no outlets to plug in my recorder, did not work. And so we ended up walking into a little restaurant, a little Italian restaurant, and they didn't seem to mind that we set up our mics and everything right there at the table, because we ordered food. You know, we wanted to make it worth their while. But they didn't mind that we did this. The only trouble was that it was a little bit noisy when we got there, and the longer we sat there, the more people came in, until it was finally a pretty huge din. I'm surprised because I guess the mics we kept so close to our lips that a lot of this background noise doesn't really affect the interview that much. But what you will hear in this interview is both Brent and me speaking very loudly because we were trying to overcome the noise in the room. And so you'll hear me, at least, if you listen to any of these things. I'm normally a soft-spoken sort of guy, but in this one, I'm talking very loudly all the way through it. And that's the reason for that. Luckily, I let Brent do most of the talking, and that's my practice in these things. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I listen to a lot of interviewers who are constantly interrupting the people that they interview. And even though every one of those people is 1,000 times more successful at this than I am, that is one thing that I do not emulate. I like to let my guests talk. So we have Brent talking about Mack Sennett and some other things. And every once in a while, I will come shouting in with a question very loudly. And that's the way this hour is going to go. I hope you'll enjoy it. I had a great time with Brent. I've known him for a long time, and he's a terrific guy and incredibly knowledgeable about not only Mack Sennett, but all manner of film history, and has a particular affection for silent comedians, as I do. So we have a lot in common and a lot to talk about, and you're about to hear us talking about it right now. Enjoy my talk with Brent Walker. I guess we start with Sennett. Where did your interest in him come up?
Well, I think it all stemmed back from when I was young, watching television and films like The Golden Age of Comedy, when comedy was king, I think I where I first got interested in, really, it was mostly the 1920s Senates, the Del Lord and Billy Bevin and the Harry Langdon, the ones that are more polished than the Keystones from the 1910s, which that's one thing with the Keystones, people have to take into context when they were made in assessing them, because, you know, and then secondly, on a lot of those were from the reissues where they actually, a friend of mine who's a really great researcher, Bo Berglund, said that he was actually looking at all the Chaplin Keystones and all the different prints, and those, some of those reissues, they literally cut four frames at the beginning and end of each shot just for some reason to make them shorter. So as a result, they look even jumpier than they were intended, and then you show them at the wrong speed or whatever, this and that. There's all, you know, but as far as my interest, it was from those compilations. I already knew about Laurel and Hardy and a lot of all the great, you know, Marx Brothers and people like that. And I kind of knew Chaplin and seeing some, but, you know, the Buster Keaton and some, getting into some of those people. But, and when I would start to seek out the books for those people, I'd find the information I was looking for, even though there were better books later. But with Senate, it was hard to find. There were books that, you know, Calton Lehue did a couple books just on the Keystone period. You know, there were some libraries that had the David Turconi book that was done in 1960, but it's all in Italian, and I didn't read Italian. It had a filmography of all the films, though, and I kind of, it was really from, I made a photocopy of the filmography, just the filmography portion from the Turconi book. I think it was at the UCLA library. And I started out, I kind of just, on my own interest, I want to see what some of these films are about, even if I can't see the films. So when I started going to the Academy Library, the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences Library, my friend and I in high school, David Hayes, were starting working on a book on the Bowery Boys and Dead End Kids that we eventually released as films of the Dead End, or films of the Bowery Boys, A Celebration of the Dead End Kids in 1984. But while I was at the Academy researching that, which there was a lot more information that could be available in the Senate collection at the Academy hadn't yet been made available, I would start going through the trades with that Turconi book, a filmography, just to look up the films and try to write down synopses. So, you know, that started, you know, probably 30 years, maybe this was like 1979 or something, and I was still, and for like about 10 years, I did that a little bit and kind of set it aside. I went to college. I did some other things. And at that point, I really, an idea of a book still wasn't. And first of all, to get back to how I chose, you know, the Bowery Boys, also there was no book on them. The Senate, there were several books. There was his autobiography. There was the Gene Fowler biography from the 30s, Fowler Goose, which both of those were, it was hard to substantiate any of what they had as facts. So between those and the Lehue books, it was like I needed to know more. I needed to know the context of how this all came together. So, and the same thing with the Bowery Boys. So that's how I kind of chose those projects, but I enjoyed the Senate films, the frenetic, you know, the gags and how they were all constructed. And I sort of, as I said, was putting together that filmography. In the meantime, I was doing other things. And then in about 1989, I got a Mac Plus, like one of the first, you know, Mac computers. And I started typing up my filmography. I don't even know what I was planning to do. I just wanted to have it typed up. And at the same time, I mean, I don't know if I was thinking about a book at that point, but at the same time, I would occasionally go up to the Academy Library and I would ask Sam Gill or somebody there, you know, hey, I knew that they had the Senate materials, but they hadn't been cataloged. So I'd periodically ask, and there were a couple of years, though, they're still not finished. And then finally, about 1990, all of a sudden the answer was, oh, they finally have finished cataloging, you know, and it's going to be made available to researchers. So I think at that point was where I realized, you know, I've got enough information for a book, and I started arranging my vacation time and whatever open time to go up there and go through a bunch of the paper files when I could over the course of about probably 4 or 5 years.
Now, what did they have at the Academy?
Well, the Senate collection has Senate saved. I guess it was, you know, like 700 crates or something I heard, or I don't know, 700, but like a bunch of boxes of... And he saved every script from when he was starting to do his own, under his own name and not Keystone, from 1917 on. And then there's some scripts from Keystone, too, for a couple of years before, a lot from the Triangle years. And the paper files include even the different drafts of the subtitles and the final subtitle sheet and various other, sometimes there's some production. For certain periods, there's the assistant director production notes on, which shows all the extras and the people that, and even, there's even some of the mocked up newspapers they used for insert shots to set up, you know, somebody had just won a lottery of all this money.
Sure.
And they have a picture of Billy Bevan or Harry Langdon and, or getting married or something. Those are in there. And then there's also stills on just about every film at a certain point. I mean, just in huge amounts. Some contracts, a lot of legal and business papers on ledgers on the films and things like that. So I went through a good portion of it. I didn't make it through everything, I think, but. And at the same time, I got some microfilm from an interlibrary loan from the Harry Roy Aitken papers in Wisconsin Historical Society, which had some the negative records for the Keystone films and some other things. So, and then, you know, a big part of it was trying to see as many films as I could. And amazingly, for his own studio from about 1912 to 1933, Sennett made about 1,000 films, which, you know, all but about 18 of them were shorts. And amazingly, through the different collectors I knew and through archives, I was able to see parts of, you know, probably over half of them. It's amazing the survival. There were still some I didn't see and some that are turning up. So it's a pretty good survival rate.
That's amazing.
A studio,
yeah.
An independent studio for a 21-year period. And
especially for an independent studio, because
that's
where they always go wrong.
Yeah, and the thing is, well, also, it's funny because the survival, the ones that survive more as of the Senate, and I think this happens a lot, he had different distributors over the years. You know, with Keystone, he was its own entity, and they distributed through Mutual and Triangle, and Keystone pretty much ceased about a year after he left in 1918. Well, those, as a result, the companies that went under, it seemed like, are the ones that the prints got reissued and they did things, whereas the times where he was releasing through Paramount in the late teens, and at the end of the thing he sold the films back to Paramount, Famous Players Lasky, well, they probably sat in the Paramount vaults and Paramount owned them, and they weren't going to do, you know, they weren't doing anything with their silent films, let alone these two real comedies from the teens. So I think at some point Paramount dumped all their silence in the ocean, you know, whatever, in the 30s, which includes like some big Paramount features from the 20s that are now, you know, would be big films, and you know, these shorts went with it. So sometimes, and the same thing when in the 20s after that, Sennett was with Pathé, who they kind of went through some reorganizations, but they did all these Pathégram 9.5 millimeter films and 16 millimeter films. So as a result, all these, not only Sennett, but Hal Roach and the Terry cartoons and different things that were Pathé are all, a lot of them survived because they were, the bones were picked more or less of the organizations that went under, whereas the big entities that kept going, there's sometimes less of a chance of survival. So
I'm interested going back a little bit to the scripts, because a lot of the films, especially the once you get to the Keystone Cop era, it seems like they just hit the action pretty soon. How scripted out are all these gags and everything?
Well, I mean, it's different from, you know, the first couple of years. There really aren't a lot of, there's some things from like 1914 or 15, but they're almost like more continuity. It's hard to tell if they're actual scripts or their continuity done after. But definitely by 1915 or 16 on, they were writing scenarios. I mean, they were written. I mean, the concept that Osennett just went out to a park and shot something, they ad-libbed something, that happened, you know, in the early, the beginning, the first couple of years, that probably happened a lot. But even then, it wasn't, you know, Osennett had a very, he was very, actually, his story oriented as far as his, he felt the stories that he, you know, had certain stories he would do over and over again. I mean, he did have certain motifs where I think one of the writers who was at the 20s even said, told somebody I knew that interviewed him in the 60s that I think it was Sam Gill, that by the 20s, you know, they were coming up with these new things, or they were coming up with some new ideas and this and that. And then Senate would go, oh, well, that sounds good, but why don't you try this and that? And he would change some things. And the next thing you knew, it was like his, you know, love triangle plot, or the father with the preferred suitor. And you know, there's certain things that he did over and over again. But there usually was some kind of a story outline by the time they were getting into, you know, a little bit later, the scripts described a lot of the action, you know, that wasn't just off the cuff.
Let's talk a little bit about Senate himself. He did make a stab at being an actor for a while. Do you think that he was a genuinely funny guy himself, or was he just, did he spot funny in others?
Well, definitely his skill was spotting the talent in others. You know, that's his, probably his greatest skill. I mean, he was probably, as a comedian, he wasn't going to go far. I mean, the funny thing is, you know, I don't think there are any evidence of his singing voice. I'm not sure. But, you know, supposedly, you know, he had a good, nice baritone. And in some of the talkies, when he speaks, he's got a great speaking voice. And when he gives speeches, there's a few dedications and this and that. And he's great. So he's definitely a very good speaker. He was, you know, he didn't really have the body type to be a comedian because he was kind of a little bit big and gawky, but he wasn't funny, large, you know, whatever. In those days, it was the stereotypes of the fatty, but a lot of the comedians that did all the physical stuff or whatever usually were very small, and, you know, their bodies were low, at low center of gravity, and could do all these things, you know, where, you know, Senate had kind of a gangly, walk, and, you know, just when he was doing these things. But I think he himself realized early on that, you know, his bread and butter wasn't going to be acting, and he also probably realized that actors may not always have as long of a career as the person, as the director or the writer or the producing the films. So I think he was happy to set that aside, but he definitely had a knack for assessing talent and training talent, because he, you know, so many of the people, he had so many directors that went on to big things, and not just the actors that went on to, and even, you know, a lot of times he was taking people that weren't trained, and he was giving them some training and giving them the ground to do it. You know, he hired a lot of, like, boxers and high divers and things like that for stunt work and this and that. But then they ended up, like, Alan McNeil, who was a boxer, one of his favorite boxers that would fight at the Vernon fights that he would go to, ended up getting put in the cutting room. And he ended up, you know, a well-known editor. You know, I think he won an Oscar for the Oxbow incident, but those were some of his, you know, he had some big editorial credits. And, you know, Richard Wallace was another one and the guys like Stuart Heisler, and started out in the editing room. And, you know, early on he had all these, you know, Frank Lloyd and Chester Franklin, you know, worked for him. And, you know, besides all the comedy directors that went, you know, the Roy Del Ruse and Eddie Klein and the Earl Kenton.
It's an astonishing list of people. And, of course, in terms of the top comics, with the exception of Keaton and Laurel and Hardy, almost everybody else.
Yeah. And the thing is that Sennett was, you know, there's always a story on how Sennett, you know, he was too cheap to pay anyone, so they all left him. But it's like, I don't even know if it was a case of him being too cheap, as most of the time he was, Fox Sunshine started a company, and they, or Fox Studios, and they threw more money at it than maybe he had, so they could hire, and he always knew that he could train somebody else, he could find talent. I mean, he sort of created his own mythology that he was this uncouth, ex-boilermaker. I think he worked when he was in New England after his family came from Canada in the late 1890s before he went to Broadway. I think he may have worked as a boilermaker for a short period of time. He makes it sound like he was, but he was already, his mother paid for him to have singing lessons and very much promoted him as an opera singer. He went to New York to try to make good as a singer, and as he ended up in Broadway choruses and being in Broadway shows. And he was always attuned to theatrical, what was going on, what was big on the theater. That's why he kept finding these people, Chaplin and hiring these names, and also, he was always going out to, scout talent. And then when he went to Los Angeles to the theaters on Broadway, the Orpheum and the Palace, the ones that had the vaudeville circuit and the plays. And so he was, I think, more attuned and more cultured than he wanted to portray himself, because really when you compare him, like, one of the differences between him and Hal Roach, where, Hal Roach kind of surpassed him by having the, better talent later on, the Laurel and Hardy's and Charlie Chase's, that kind of resonated more made the transition to the talkies a lot better. But, Roach really was a guy with no experience in any kind of show business other than until he got hired as an extra with Harold Lloyd. And he didn't really seem to have, he kind of was more of an ambition to be a businessman and, play polo. I mean, Sennett was kind of a sportsman too. He went hunting and he played golf, whatever, but he didn't, Roach was content to hire people who knew they were doing and kind of stay out of their way and be, whereas Sennett, he realized he had to delegate at a certain point because it was getting bigger and bigger, but he still always had a hand in supervisorially and always was attuned to what was going on. And he also had more of a personal, because, after people left and after he finished, they would still have these reunions. People would come back to pay tribute to him and hang out. And I think in general, he was kind of more of a man of the people, than a lot of the other people that ran studios that kind of liked to set up the separation of the boss. Now, send it out. He did have the Irish temper where he would blow up at somebody and, fire them. And then the next day, they're clearing out their stuff. He's like, where are you going? Come back here. And he didn't think anything of it. And it's like some people took that. There were some people that took that the wrong way, but most people kind of realized it was part of his bluster. And it's like, oh, wait till the old man cools down. And kind of, because really he was the kind of guy who, in going through his ledgers, he would lend money to people that in need. I mean, even though Roscoe Arbuckle left him in 1917, he was always friends. And in 1929 or something like that, there's a thing about him lending Arbuckle some money for car payments because Arbuckle was having trouble after all of this. And there's a couple other, like Eddie Sutherland, who was became another one of the guys who became a director, but he was an actor at Keystone, and he was a bit of a kind of a playboy or kind of a one of the guys who were gallivanting out at night and taking out the girls and drinking. And he was dating at the time, he was dating Constance Talmadge, and one night, he, in driving, I'm sure he had a bit to drink, he wrecked the Talmadge car, which I guess was Mr. Talmadge's car, the father. And so he came to Mac, you know, and said, you know, I need $500 or, you know, Mr. Talmadge is going to kill me. He doesn't know about, you know, to replace the car before he finds out. And Senate lent him, you know, the money to, you know, so it's like Senate would do that, which is part of also why he wasn't a very successful always businessman as a studio head. You know, he did make a lot of money in investments in the 20s, and he lost a lot of it in the crash. And I guess because, and he had some trouble after the studio, he was bankrupt. But then I guess when his mother passed away in Canada in 1936, he had given his mother some money, and his mother had stashed it away. She hadn't put it in the stock market or anything. So I think, and I don't really know, but you know, after his mother died in 1936, was he had enough money to get the furnished apartment at the Garden Court where he lived the rest of his life. And he was pretty much on a fixed income. I mean, he didn't have a lot of money, but he had enough to cover where he could live. And kind of, I think that might explain why. I mean, I haven't seen what his exact finances. I know when he died, supposedly all he had were literary rights, and he donated those to some orphan homes or
Yikes.
Something. But he was, you know, he was able to kind of not. I've talked about comebacks in films, and he would do these little things, but he never. I'm sure he could have if he really wanted to. Got a job as a producer at PRC or something, or you know, do it. But it seems like he kind of wanted to do things kind of on his terms after running his own studio for 20 years. But
yeah,
maybe he had just enough or whatever towards the rent that he could say no, or he could like not. He wasn't desperate enough to have to do that, but yet he wasn't super well off either. You know, so.
Yeah, it seems like with that many films in the can, somebody who had that library now would be a multimillionaire.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a lot of the times he did. Like, he sold his films to the First National Films, to Warner Brothers, in, like, the late 30s or early 40s, and they did those Vitaphone shorts, the compilations of the films, and re-editings of some of them, and so he probably made some money from that. He had the stories that he sold to Jules White, you know, for remakes on the Columbia shorts. He probably made a little on that. Not a lot on those, I think, because I think they were maybe, I think Ed Watts looked through the Jules White collection and says maybe he got $50 or whatever for a script or something. But
what always strikes me about his films now is just how jam-packed they are with amazing people.
Yeah.
And especially if you're looking in the 20s, you're seeing all the Jimmy Finlayson and Bud Jameson and all these people who you're going to see in arguably better stuff later. I mean, Jimmy Finlayson is in all the Laurel and Hardy films and all that stuff. But Senate saw them all and knew that.
Well, I mean, in not all cases better later, because it's, you know, like, for instance, you know, Vernon Dent was in the with Langdon and with Ben Billy Bevan and whatever. And those, a lot of those 20s, the Pathé shorts, you know, hold up very well, and gags. And actually, a lot of them, the different periods, hold up pretty well. It depends on, you know, like I said, some of the earlier ones, you kind of have to look at it in the context. The other thing that it's important in understanding Senate versus other forms of comedy, particularly the early Senate, is, you know, as you see on every film, the Keystone films, it says farce comedy. And there's a difference between farce and slapstick and whatever. And a lot of his early, even though he did, you know, things that became hallmarks of slapstick, going back to Biograph, a lot of the things he was doing were, you know, farce was, you know, in those days, it was even something risque where, you know, somebody catches somebody in somebody else's bedroom and doing this, and things that are caught in their underwear and things where it's a spoof of, there's a lot of the early Senate films where he's spoofing Griffith films. He's spoofing old melodrama, stage melodrama motifs, other stage motifs, where nowadays if you watch those films and you don't have that background to understand, it looks like people running around doing in certain situations, but if you realize what they're doing, you know, and there's some of the things like Ford Sterling, who was one of his top early comedians, and people in later years, oh, Ford Sterling is overacting and this and that. It's like, well, no, he's doing the, what was the melodramatic villain. He's sending it up with, in, you know, purposely being that way. And there's a lot of things where the context has been removed now to understand. So the earlier ones, I think the later you kind of, they still work on without a lot of, context, knowing the context. But.
Yeah, you know, I used to always hear from people, if they didn't know that much about silent films, they always assumed it was about villains twisting their mustaches and tying women to railroad tracks and that sort of thing. And in fact, that probably never happened seriously in a movie ever. It's almost always a send-up of something else. You see it a lot in comedies.
Yeah. And they're sending up as much as they're sending up the films. They're sending up a lot of the, you know, there were those stage things with like Blue Jeans was one, and the Drunkard and whatever that played for years, that touring companies would just, you know, and in those days in the 1890s or early 1900s, this was even before, you know, well, movies were started, but there was no TV, there was no radio, whatever. People in these small towns in the, you know, middle of the country, you know, then they never, there was never, never going to see the broad, they were never going to see the Ziegfeld Follies or, you know, one of those big Broadway shows. And they, you know, they might not even have a theater, but there was some touring company that was going to come through their town and, you know, doing these, yeah, melodramas or these,
East Lynn.
Yeah, that's, you know, so that's
Uncle Tom's Cabin.
It's really, you know, Sennett was sending that stuff up a lot in those, with the villains and,
off topic, but I saw W.C. Fields The Old Fashioned Way a while back and was struck by how much he's not sending up the drunkard in that film.
Yeah.
But pretty much presenting it like it would have been seen,
mm-hmm,
which makes that a very valuable little document, because you know that a lot of those people in that film had been in drunkard companies.
Yeah. And they were the cast from the Los Angeles one that played,
yeah,
for years. And there's another film made the same year, which I've never seen. That's it's like a low budget version of The Drunkard by a Poverty Row company. But yeah, that, I mean, that's a case also where, you know, and that was directed by William Bodine, who's a guy who started out with Sennett at Biograph. He was Sennett's assistant cameraman, director. He later directed for, you know, in Field's work for him. So there's always a connection with Sennett and the people that.
And he spans your books.
Yeah.
He did Bowery Boys too, didn't he?
Bodine, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he did more, yeah, the Bowery Boys. But, yeah, a lot of the guys that directed Fields, you know, Eddie Klein, Earl Kenton, Eddie Sutherland, you know, all Sennett guys. So there's actually in The Bank Dick, there's a scene where there's a shooting a location, and I think Jack Norton plays, yeah, the director who's too drunk, and They end up getting Fields, and Fields says, you know, I used to direct for Max Sennett back in the day. Well, the irony is, you know, besides the fact that he did work for Max Sennett, that film was directed by Eddie Klein, who directed for Sennett, started with Sennett, you know, and a lot of the people that did direct Fields were Sennett, ex-Sennett directors, so it was not too far from the truth. But yeah, that's what, you know, a lot of those things are satires, and just, you know, that it, and it was really, even if you can actually see the transition in from Biograph to Keystone, because it really, there weren't a lot of films being made where the lower classes, so to speak, were like the comedy were depicted as much. Like, even at Biograph, if you notice Biograph films that Sennett directed with Fred Mace, a lot of them Fred Mace with Mabel, a lot of times it's these guys who belong to you know, gentleman's club or whatever. One of them's pulling a trick on the other that dresses in drag. Do this. There's a lot of that kind of thing. And those are obviously like upper class. They belong to guys who belong to a club were part of the, you know, the upper strata of the town. It wasn't the cobbler and whatever. And then at Keystone, they started making the films where it was, you know, that's the other thing is, there were a lot of racial, of course, there was some blackface at Keystone. There was, the Italian, Irish, Mexican, different things. But in vaudeville, going back to an early vaudeville and when like New York was a melting pot and it was those people were the immigrants, and the Dutch comedy too, which Ford Sterling did, which goes back to Weber and Fields and these guys with these funny goatees and they're doing talking in this funny accent and the people that were playing at those theaters in the Bowery, which again weren't the Broadway shows. They were these were people they would never be able to even get admittance in a Broadway show if they had the money because they weren't of the right in the right set or whatever, but they were going to these things in the there would be like an Irish character, all the Irish people would applaud, and there'd be an Italian character, all the Italian, so that's kind of what Sennett was playing to. And he would, the cops was kind of the representative of the authority figure in either cops. He also had a lot of judges. Sennett did a lot of things where, the police chief or the mayor or a judge would be caught, with his pants down or with a woman in his room by his wife, all these things. He was playing these films to the class of people that would roar at seeing like the upper strata being taken down, a peg because they were, were the lowly, they didn't, weren't allowed in that rarefied air kind of in those days. I mean, there was a lot more of the class structure than even in, the U.S. and besides whatever racial thing, just even the, so it's accented definitely when you go from the Biograph to the Keystone, you see that transition.
Sure. It's interesting to think about all the racial stereotypes because as you were just saying, it's a much more complicated issue.
Yeah.
Than people think it is, because now it just looks like all the different ethnic stereotypes are just being made fun of, but that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, even it's really complex, and it's kind of a thing that's even hard to say or hard to, but in a certain way, the minstrel shows and things, and now that kind of thing, was actually believed that the African American music and things that were coming in, and it really wasn't like polite society. You didn't listen to that ragtime. That was you listened to the classical music from Europe. And when people started singing, it was believed that you couldn't even sing that music unless you dressed up. You played the part, and in a way, so in a way, it was like a lot of the people were doing it because they loved the music or whatever that the motifs, and it was almost like the Eminem or the white rappers that take the persona of the black rapper
or even Elvis.
There was a whole lot of racism going also and a whole lot of inequality because the people the theaters were. Were segregated or not even, loud, but there's like definitely complexity because Sennett did, there's some, a couple films where like they're blackface films where they're pretty, pretty horrific in the stereotyping. And yet in like 1915, they're talking about like when he had all this Broadway stars and, Burt Williams, who was one of the first, the African American comedian who was on Broadway in the Ziegfeld Follies, was visiting Sennett's studio, and Sennett showed him some rushes of, and he was like, it was like one of the, Photo Player Weekly, they're talking about, Burt Williams' reaction to some of the Keystones, and Sennett showing him how, oh, you're doing good, and this and that, but then Burt Williams did some films for Vitagraph on the East Coast, but, it's definitely, there's some complexity because there of course was a whole, lot of racism, so that can't, you can't really downplay that, but it's, there's some complexity too.
Can't.
It's
just not as simple as people think it is.
Yeah.
It's, there's no denying that people were mistreated and ridiculed in some cases, but that's not always the case.
Yeah, but it's when you see that it's, the person isn't doing it, you know, when, you know, like, I guess Al Jolson, I think I heard that, you know, you see him doing it, that's what he, there was something where UB Blake and Noble Sissel were doing something in Connecticut and, they wouldn't allow him or whatever. This theater in Al Jolson came up and berated the people or whatever and whatever that owned the theater that wouldn't let him do, you know, whatever that was, you know, he, at the same time, he's, you know, dressing in blackface and doing his mammy and whatever.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's really hard to, you know, understand now when you look at, well, why you, you know.
Yeah, there were
the
people.
The mentality with they're going at it was a whole different mentality.
There were people who thought of it as tribute. Fred Astaire doing the Bojangles number in Swing Time. It's, or is it Shall We Dance? Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Whichever one. I always get those two mixed up. But it's clear that he loves Bill Bojangles Robinson and wants to do it, but he does it in blackface, mm-hmm. and it's a weird thing. And you gotta, that's another one of the things we were talking earlier about, without context of the Senate, the parodies, you don't quite get everything that they were doing, and it's the same thing with all this stuff, without the context. Without understanding the period and what was going on, you don't really understand. It just all looks like bad stuff,
mm-hmm.
when in fact it wasn't.
Yeah, and the thing is also with the Senate films, you can kind of tell, like with the blackface, early on they had some blackface things. Then you didn't see that for a long time. And in the 20s, particularly in the films of Del Lord, who did like these, a lot of these gags, but it seemed like, you know, Del Lord always had like the scared black guy with some really offensive gags where he would, you know, one of them was one of the worst where it's, he like gets so scared he turns to dust or whatever. And there's, you know, that the kind of things where he turns what, and so you kind of realize that, well, maybe that's, you know, that's Del Lord. And, cause he didn't see it in these other films and you hadn't seen it with Senate doing it, or, you know, it kind of varies on who's, you know, doing the film.
It really is, yeah. I was watching Ghostbreakers not long ago, and Bob Hope has an actually, like, he's like chums with...
But I think one of those, I think that's the one where he's kind of, like, especially mean-spirited to Willie Best. And I'm a huge Bob Hope fan of his films.
Too.
I think he's, like, really underrated. I just want to remember, and that's a funny film, but I think I remember that one. At least at the beginning, he's kind of like, well, maybe it's just the script because they give him all these, you know, it's like a blackout and whatever those kind of.
Oh, sure,
like,
there was stuff like that. But Bob Hope eventually honed his character to be this brave coward or this arrogant coward,
right?
And in Ghostbreakers, it's like he and Willie Best are playing what would eventually just be the Bob Hope character,
mm-hmm.
but they've split it up.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to watch it. But then you look at the...
That's true. I never thought
the,
about that.
The Will Rogers films, when he is absolutely mean to Step and Fetch It and insulting and demeaning. And as much as I seem to like Will Rogers generally, I hate him in those films.
But you think, I think like, that's only in those... The couple of the John Ford, Ford ones. Because I actually, you know, in watching those, I actually like some of the earlier Will Rogers better than the, you know, even though the people, the Ford ones were kind of, when I finally like sat down and watched all of them, I don't know if the Ford ones were really my favorite Rogers, even though they're the ones that are the most like lavishly mounted and they get the period and all that. But yeah, I think those are the only ones, like those last couple, you know, two or three that Step and Fetch It. But yeah, and it's not something you bring from Will Rogers where you never met a man I didn't like, whatever.
Yeah, it's very odd. One of the things I've been getting out of the Senate is I've been watching, TCM showed a whole bunch of them a few months ago, and I watched all of that.
Those were from Cine Museum, Paul Gorecki and Brittany Valente, who are restoring all those. I think they're going to be... on DVD coming up some point.
I was real interested in all of them. I didn't find all of them all that funny, but I did find some of them funny. But when I didn't find them funny, I'm such a location guy. I love atmosphere. I love the sense of place and time. And so many of those things were just so lovely to look at.
Yeah.
And boy, did they go to Echo Park a lot, especially in those early days.
They went to Echo Park a lot. Then they went to Hollenbeck Park a lot.
Yeah.
And you can actually watch from the teens up through the 20s the development of the Echo Park and the Silver Lake area,
yeah.
Which Sennett had a lot to do. You know, he was involved with some of the real estate and things too, I think. But where in the Keystones, there's, you know, a lot of like dirt roads and a house here and a house there, you know, and then by that, and it's like paved and there's lots of houses and they're going up through Silver. You realize it's like Silver Lake with hardly any houses in like 1924, and by 1926 it's going to be full of houses in those hills around the reservoir. And so you could actually like kind of chart the growth of the 1920s building boom in Los Angeles through those films, and through a lot of the, you know, not just Sennett's films, but a lot of the comedies, more than the other films of the 20s, because the comedies had so many chases where they would take to the streets. You know, what's funny is in general with any era, the seem like the bigger the studio and the more lavish the picture, the less it captures the era, because Ben-Hur, they're building all their own set. They're making their own Rome on the lot. So, you know, or they're, you know, that's a period piece, or even films that take place in the current day, you know, they build all the sets so they never have to go outside of the studio, you know, unless it's a specific location, then they can afford to go on location wherever. But the comedies and the lower budget, you know, films, you know, they would go outside and steal some shots off of the street. And as a result, you get, more feeling of the period and the location.
It's like I always say, every movie, especially every movie shot outside, is an accidental documentary. And it's just a picture of a place and time. And no matter what the movie is about or how good or bad it is, there are always these things going on in the background.
Yeah.
And it's I think still something that people don't pay as much attention to as they should. But I find myself looking at that stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this Sennett stuff, especially the mid-teens, late teens, it all just feels so sun-drenched and rural and...
Mm-hmm.
It's just beautiful to look at.
Yeah, it was.
I wanted to ask you about your mom. I wanted you to tell people a little bit about her, because I know you just had this ceremony, but I think it's worth mentioning. Did you get your interest in history from her?
I definitely got interested in history from her and in writing, because she was. To backtrack on her, she was from Cleveland, and she was the first female editor of the Case Western Reserve University newspaper when she was, in college there. She went, met my father in Chicago. They were working for Brunswick. She was editing the newsletter, but she came out in California, first in Los Angeles and then down to Dana Point in Southern Orange County. And was worked for newspapers down there. And in doing so, she kind of documented when things were being torn down. And we went out, like this old beach club from the 20s was torn down in the, you know, late 60s. And went out and took pictures of it. There was an old cowboy bunkhouse from the 1880s that was still there in San Juan Capistrano that got torn down for a housing tract. Because, you know, you always needed another housing tract more than you need a remaining 1880s cowboy bunkhouse, you know. So I kind of, you know, she ended up writing the history of Dana Point Harbor and that area, Capistrano Bay to San Juan Capistrano, another number of history things. So I kind of got interested in the films, just watching the old films on TV and the old comedies. But she was kind of the one that instilled with me the idea that, hey, you know, even when I was maybe, you know, 12 or whatever, I could type up. I mean, my friend David and I would start typing up these little books that were just on a typewriter. We'd type them and you know, and on the book on the Marx Brothers or Laurel and Hardy, whatever, we would get a lot of it from another book, but also from watching, you know, we'd seen some of the films, and we would just kind of like staple these, like do carbon copies, and there'd be two copies or whatever, one for each, or, you know, and staple them together. And, but she kind of encouraged that, you know, you can research this stuff. And I met some people at the time were older, meaning like maybe 3 or 4 years older, like Randy Skretved and the Lenberg brothers through the Sons of the Desert, who were also working on books on, you know, Laurel and Hardy, Randy, and the Lenbergs were working on the Three Stooges. So I kind of tagged along with them to the Academy. But I think my mother, definitely, but anyway, she, also founded the Festival of Wales down there and some other, the Historical Society down there. And when she was working on her book, and I was kind of just researching Max Sennett at the time, but not necessarily working on a book, the Dana Point was a housing development of the 20s that was developed by the same group, the Woodruff Group, that developed Hollywoodland. And of course, Sennett was involved in both of those. He was a backer of Woodruff in Hollywoodland and Dana Point, and she actually found a letter, and she, in going through her stuff on the Dana Point, she found a letter on Max Sennett Comedy's stationery extolling the virtues. Actually, it was to L.J. Burritt, who was Woodruff's right-hand man, and who was the father of Billy Burritt, the kid actor, and the later, you know, animal TV host. But, you know, Max Sennett's extolling, you know, Dana Point is America's playground, whatever, and he sent some bathing girls down. So that was like an area where my mother's and my research overlapped for a moment. And so I think that she encouraged me a lot. And, yeah, when she passed away a year and a half ago, the city of Dana Point, in gratitude for what she had given the community, because there everyone, her book on is the history that people that moved to the community buy and they renamed an overlook that overlooks the Dana Point Harbor, the Doris Walker Overlook, and the artist did an amazing bronze plaque, and they have a whole biography of her and things. So that was really, you know, something I was really grateful for.
Yeah, I was so impressed by that. I kind of expected it was just going to be a plaque.
Yeah, and I originally thought it was going to be one thing with the bronze. I knew that was going to be there, but then they ended up putting part of it out in the entrance on these sort of, they made some concrete rocks.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It would look really nice. I mean, it's just, I'm just so amazed, and for her, I'm honored in what they did. And yeah, I don't think without her encouraging me, I would have, done, you know, taken the aspect of that I can do a book, you know, and I might have said, you know, you gotta be, you know, whatever it is. I can't do that, but it was just, you know.
That's great. And the dedication of that was just a couple of days ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was last Tuesday of this past week. It was April 16th, 2013. So
yeah, I saw the 20th, pictures. So. I think you've posted on Facebook.
Yeah, I was able to salvage a lot of her photos and different things, historical things I've been scanning and posting. And, I mean, she just took some amazing pictures of things, you know, that... You know, well, another thing we did when she was working for the Sun Post down there, and they were first building the harbor, Dana Point Harbor, one of the guys who was involved in the building of the harbor was a friend of John Wayne, who, of course, lived in Balboa, Newport Harbor, and had a boat, the Wild Goose, that was an old converted minesweeper or whatever. But at one point, even before they had really built the harbor, there was a press thing at the harbor to promote the harbor, and they brought the Wild Goose down, and I went with my mom, and we all went on the boat up, and he wasn't on the boat, but we went up to Newport Harbor, and we drove past he and Pilar, and their kids were waving at us, I remember. And then later my mom went on another thing, and Wayne was on there. She got her picture with him, and she took his picture. There was a few different times where he was in the harbor or something. So she was in the harbor with, you know, John Wayne. So there was a lot of, there was some interesting people that lived down that way, because also Lon Chaney Jr. lived there. And it, I don't remember this reason, but my mom took pictures of him showing some kids how to fish. And then he, I think he had a boat, or he was on this other guy's boat. I don't know. There was, you know, some interesting celebrities that were, like, of that area. So it was, you know, J. Pat O'Malley, the you know, Disney films and whatever, lived sure. in San Juan Capistrano, and Don Beto, who I didn't know by name, but, you know, one of those guys who's been in probably sure. more films than anyone, you know, and at the time, I didn't even realize that. I think I'd seen him in Three Stooges, I think it's Three Smart Saps, where he's the husband of the, Lorna Gray is the zany wife, the cream puff fight. But my dad was like, my dad was a house appraiser for this County of Orange, and he goes, oh, you know what, right down here, this old character actor, Don Beto, who lives, I was just there, we can go down and say hi to him. I'm like, I had no, the name didn't mean anything, but we walked in, and it was just like this nice old guy and his wife invited us in, and spent some time in their house, and then later on, when I realized who he was, and it's like, oh, you know, I wish I'd known whatever the questions to ask, but it was...
Yeah. Yeah, that's always too bad. There are several people I met too soon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I wish I, you know, Joe Rock, who was...
Wow.
Producer, he used to always be at these different Laurel and Hardy events. Even, like, one of the first ones, I think Billy Bletcher was still alive, and he was there. You know, and later on, Joe Rock, before he became a producer and produced Stan Laurel and the Three Fat Men and some of these other, he did some documentaries. He was a comedian, a stuntman, actually. And I mean, he was probably 4 foot 10 or 4 foot 11. I mean, he was like a really tiny little guy, old tiny old guy when I saw him. And when I saw some of the films he made some films called Montgomery and Rock, who were a comedy team for Vitagraph at the same time as Larry Seaman, and none of their films survive that anyone knows. Maybe one or two in an archive, and I've never seen them. But in the 20s, he starred in some other comedies, and he's just, it's amazing. There's one that takes place in a mine, and he's jumping, he's running and jumping and all, you know, just doing some amazing stunts. I mean, he's not a great, you know, comedian, but he's just amazing physically. And I just wish I had, well, I'd seen that when I had seen him. So I go, but you're just amazing how you're doing what you're doing. It was just this little old man that I saw. But it's later on, the questions that you wish you had asked these people at the time.
Yep, always the way. Too bad. Well, at least I asked you these questions while we still had time. So, well, we should clear it up, and we'll do this again sometime in a quieter location.
Yeah.
We can do part two. But I really appreciate your taking the time to do it.
Well,
now, what are you working on now?
Well, you know, I really, as far as books, I had some ideas. I mean, the two that I really wanted to get out from the time I was a teenager were The Bowery Boys and Max Sennett. So now I've fulfilled those. I mean, I guess those were the bucket list items. I had some other ideas on, I don't even want to talk about them because...
Sure.
In the past, I've even one of my book jackets, it mentioned a book I was working on, and it never really went to fruition, to the point where somebody else, later on, they did a book, and they contacted me going, I just want to, you know, I'm doing that, I hope I'm not stepping on your, I'm like, oh, that's long, you know, I tried to do that, and it just didn't work out, and so, but I, between a few other projects, and some things with my mother, dealing with that, and my dad, who's in, you know, a... home to be cared for and things I do music and band and working. I just haven't had a chance for any writing. I had a few projects in the offing. I've done a couple of articles. I actually did an article last, I think it came out last year in the Noir City Sentinel, the Film Noir Film Noir Foundation's a really great publication they do on Crane Wilbur, who's somebody that I kind of just got interested because I realized for years I had enjoyed these films that he did, that he wrote. He was kind of like the prison movie guy for some, you know, he wrote, I remember like when I did the Bowery Boys book and the Dead End Kids, he wrote Crime School, and I think he may have written Hell's Kitchen. Then later on he did, you know, the Canyon City, Inside the Walls of Folsom Prison, which is a song where Johnny Cash saw it when he was in the Air Force, and they are going to write a song about that. And, you know, he wrote The House of Wax, you know, the adaptation of that, and The Phoenix City Story, one of the great, and He Walked by Night, some great film noir. And I just one day I realized, you know, this is a guy, he started out, you know, as an actor in films. You know, the thing he's known for is as the hero in Perils of Pauline opposite Pearl White. And but when you start looking at his career, it's just an amazing, because he actually started out as an actor in on the stage, but he was also writing like little, in even 1908, 1909, he was writing little playlets for vaudevillians and writing all these things and just little pieces for people. So he was a writer, and I guess he always considered himself a writer, not an actor. But he became a, for a few years after Perils of Pauline, with a couple of the studios, Lubin and Horsley and whatever, you know, kind of a big actor. But he went back to Broadway. He decided he wanted to be, you know, a writer. He went back to Broadway as an actor, but also writing plays. And he wrote The Monster that became a Lon Chaney film. He wrote these things, and he in the 20s, he was writing Broadway plays. Then he came back to films as a writer and director. So it's just, and he was doing these real, like, things that are based on true stories. It was like a specialty. So it's just a really interesting career. I'm interested in those, particularly the people that have history in the silent era that went forward. You know, there's all those guys that started out, you know, Howard Hickman, Oscar Apfel. There's a path of guys who start out in silent films as actors, became directors in the silent era, and then sound came, and they went back to acting in supporting roles and bit roles. So that's like another interesting path. So
yeah, it's too bad the world does not allow books like that anymore, because yeah, there's all sorts of. I did a book one time called Between Action and Cut: Five American Directors, and I wrote the chapter on Charlie Barton, and you know, Crane Wilbur would have been a perfect one to add to that. It's just too bad, because there's so many of those guys who are so interesting. Like George Marshall, for God's sake. Who was ever better than George Marshall? And yet nobody's ever written anything about
him. And the thing, he's a guy that, for some reason, they only allow, like, the auteur theory with certain guys, certain people. But when you look at the work, I mean, like George Marshall, He did just a whole bunch of different genres and some really great film. I mean, he did, you know, Destry Rides Again. He did, like, the same year he did Monsieur Beaucaire, one of Bob Hope's best films, and The Blue Dahlia, you know. It's
amazing.
Yeah.
He could just do anything. He was like Michael Curtiz in a way.
Yeah.
That there's really nothing you can point to particularly that's like a directorial style. Yet, just always great.
You can always make a story work in the best possible way. You know, that's.
And there's so many guys like that. It's too bad we live in a world where you can't write books about them. However, we can do podcasts about them. So that's what we do. So anyway, let's wrap it up. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Frank.
I sure hope you enjoyed that talk with Brent Walker as much as I did. And I probably enjoyed it more because my talk with him involved garlic rolls. Those were so good. As a matter of fact, my wife loves garlic, and this place had these yeasty garlic rolls, and it looked like about a clove of garlic diced up on top of each roll. Man, oh man, were they good. And so just as we were leaving, I was paying the bill, and I asked the guy to sell me a few of those so I could bring them back to my wife. And he said, oh, I'll give you some. And he brought me over three in a little box. And I packed up my recorder, and I packed up the microphones, and rolled up all the wires and all that stuff, and walked out and left them sitting on the table. And even though it's been a week, I still regret every second of that. I want to go back. I want to get those garlic rolls. They're great. Anyway, that's probably a digression from the issue of the commentary track. Yet, I like to share moments of my personal life with you because I feel that we're friends. And because we're friends, I want you to go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and I want you to order books and DVDs, and I want you to do it through the Amazon links on the page. Brent's book will be linked on the page, and My books are all there. You can order them directly. My film, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, my documentary, is finally finished. It's at the DVD replicators, even as we speak. The great Michael Mortilla, who has done such incredible work on this thing. He wrote the score for the parody, the Beaugest parody, that is what the film is, the documentary is about. He gave me some additional music for the documentary. He just designed the DVD artwork, and I just okayed the final draft of that this morning, and it's a lovely thing to see. Is there anything he can't do? I don't believe so. He actually, he even did a sound mix. He did the sound mix for this thing. I think next time I make a film, I'm simply going to go to Michael Mortilla with just an idea and just let him execute everything, because he's good at all of it. But anyway, I digress again. I'm doing a lot of that today. But go to the website, order through the Amazon link. I'll get a little bit of a kickback. If you do buy Brett's book, then he'll be happy to get that sale. I'll be happy to get that kickback. Amazon will be happy to make the sale. The publishers will be happy to have sold a book. This is a way to spread joy all around the world. Is world peace only one Amazon click away? I think it can be. And I think you can prove it to yourself today by ordering through my website, thecommentarytrack.com. And then tomorrow will be, it'll be like those old Pepsi commercials. Pepsi commercials. It's Coke commercials. Really, what's the difference? Come on, folks, what's the difference? But I would like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. So, I want to thank Claire McCullough Thompson, my beautiful, wonderful, dulcet-toned wife, for being my announcer. Thank, as always, James Hutchins for designing the websites, thecommentarytrack.com, and my personal website, frankthompson.tv. Please go to both of them. Also, go to Facebook. There's a Lost Remake of Beaugest page on Facebook, and I hope that you will go look through it and hit the like button. There's a lot of pictures on that Facebook page that are not in the film. There's a lot of background stuff that I just didn't have time to deal with in the film. So look at it as extra stuff. There's also a Commentary Track Facebook page, and I hope that you will go there and always be kept abreast of what's going on in the world of this podcast. Well, there's really not that much going on in this podcast except the podcast itself. Nevertheless, you should go there. I always want to thank the great Rob Clearfield and the great, my dear friend, Gary Rand, for writing our theme music, which I love so much. And as I've said before, Rob Clearfield also wrote most of the music for my documentary. Michael Mortilla filled in some holes here and there, but Rob Clearfield did the majority of that score. And it's beautiful stuff. He had himself on piano and had a violinist and a cellist. And it really sounds like a movie score, and I love it, and I think everybody's going to be very happy when they finally see this thing in the very near future. So, that wraps up this one. I hope that you will come back next week for another scintillating hour or 2 hours or however long I go. Talk about film and film history and filmmakers, and we've got some exciting guests coming up, so please stick with us, tell your friends. Go to iTunes and leave a good review and hit the 5-star button there and make sure that other people get to this podcast, because I really want to make sure that people hear this, and it's the only way that I'm ever going to become a multimillionaire and have my own private island where I can hunt the most dangerous game, humans. But I probably revealed too much. I just want a successful podcast. That's all I want. So go there and like it. Go to iTunes, say how much you like it with 5-star rating and a nice review, and I will dance at your wedding. I swear I will. So we'll see you next week. And in the meantime, don't worry. We're going to fix it in post.